come from a different part of the research, system, and that's industry. I do want to make one correction from our first speaker. The vast majority of scientific research is done in companies, not in academic institutions. And the vast majority of that never sees a dark print. Or if it does, it's 10 to 15 years out, usually. Well, that's shrunk quite a bit in terms of some of the biotech areas. But in my area, geology, particularly the energy industry, companies, and we all know them as the great Satan companies, right? You know, Exxon, Shell, et cetera, BP, worst of them all. I have to use those terms just to introduce myself. So I never worked for any of them, but I did work in the energy industry in the U.S. as a consultant with small companies, and then mostly as an author, and various other things. In any case, a lot of that data that they generate is enormous. The technological capabilities of the large oil companies are just spectacular. The amount of money they spend on data acquisition and proprietary ownership of that is really enormous. So it's always been a formula that I was told from graduate school until today that basically the major oil companies are about 10 years ahead of a lot of academic research because of the data that they collect and that they do not release. So there's another kind of data wall, a firewall there. Anyway, this is not what I wanted to talk about. It has nothing to do with what I want to talk about, but I wanted to make that correction. I've been a lecturer at UW for about 9 years. Mostly I'm what would be called an independent scholar. I've retired from the oil industry, particularly since the early 2000s. And I'll tell you why. It's a very personal reason, but it also has to do with the ethics of science. And that is that very early on in the 2000s, when climate change was becoming a large issue in the U.S., most of the major oil companies came out very strongly against it. And the organization, sort of the umbrella organization for petroleum geologists, geophysicists, and petroleum engineers, came out very strictly against the possibility of climate change. In fact, the science director who offered me the job said, you know, you have to basically take this stance. And I had never looked at the data, so I didn't know what to say. So I sat down and looked at the data, and the data is pretty clear, even then. Even before Jim Hansen got on MSNBC, the data was quite clear, and it was, for me, a scandal to see lots of very high-level PhD scientists who actually turned their face away from the data. It's quite striking. Now, of course, they all admit that it's true because they can't deny it any longer because the science is just too powerful. And as scientists, they can only go so far against it. But it's a very interesting political development within the geologic science community as a whole that's taken place. Anyway, I'm sorry to go on about all this. I'm really talking about English in the scientific journal today. So here, that was Castor, here's Pollux. So let's go ahead. So what I want to do is sort of come at this from a very different angle than the pragmatic one people have talked about. I've just written a book about this that's come out from the University of Chicago. It has a nice red cover. It's very nice. University of Chicago is a wonderful press. Any representative? They're a wonderful press. They keep your books in print, which is what an author likes more than anything. Because, of course, we all know we're not recognized until we're dead. You know, it's a good career move for a lot of writers. Anyway. So I have a copy of that back there and a couple of other books. I wrote a book for Chicago in the early 2000s called The Chicago Guide of Communicating Science. It's used here on campus in a few courses. I talk a lot about some of the issues that have been discussed here today, and we're doing an update, probably a second edition, probably out of 2015. So I don't have that to show you yet, but I will perhaps the next time. In any case, how global is English in international science? This is sort of going on in the background to what we're all talking about. We're all talking in English, and what we're really talking about are journals published in English, international journals. And in terms of the global system of science, this is a very recent thing that English has become a full global language. Science has never had a global language before. In fact, the world has never really had a single global language. I assume there are Christians, and, well, maybe that's a bad assumption, but in any case, after battle, I'll put it that way. But it's a very new thing for science. When I was in graduate school in the late 70s, German was the language you had to learn still at that point. That changed very quickly within a decade. And I think, as everybody who's in the research community probably knows, now, you know, the fact that the world of science, international science, that is written in English, and international scientific meetings are conducted in English, is light from a dead star. Okay? It's just not news anymore. But there are many impacts. Some of them are not so good, and some of them I think are very good. That's what I discuss in this book, Does Science Need Global Language? So after talking about the impacts of this talk, I'm going to talk about lingua franca in the past, because science has had quite a number of them, and they give us some very interesting information about what we might expect from the future. And then the question that Glenn really wanted me to talk about is, what kind of scientific English is this? And so what I'm going to show you are a series of samples for you to be able to read yourself. We'll do a little bit of empirical work here. And to derive your own conclusions. And I'll talk about that when we get there. So first, I want to look at science as a globalizing phenomenon, because this is, again, quite new. And I'll show you a lot of pictures. I'm a geologist. We see things through pictures. We love pictures. In fact, if you were to compare our journals to other journals, we have more pictures. And we have them in color. And that is a great thing. That is really a great thing. Not just because we love colors, but because of the distinctions that can be made. Very important. I realize in the biological sciences you do the same. We consider it a mark of pride. In any case, I digress again. So this is a graph from Science and Engineering Indicators, which is an interesting publication put out every 2 years by the National Science Foundation. Basically, it's how is the U.S. competing against the rest of the world in scientific output. But it's a little more than that. But they do a lot of comparisons. And on this particular image, we can see that Europe surpassed the U.S. finally in 1995, and their publications have pretty much continued to climb. We see a little dip in the recession after 2008, but what we want to look at first is the Asia 10, which includes a fair number of the East Asian, South Asian, and Southeast Asian countries: India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and then the Asia 10 is China and Japan are added to that. Excuse me. But there's one other thing I want you to look at. So you can see them climbing. But then there's this little line here. This is the rest of the world. This is the globe. This is the vast majority of companies. This includes developing nations all around the world. And they are climbing at a very rapid rate also. And notice that this has really started in the 2000s, very, very late 90s, and in the 2000s, a very new phenomenon. And this is all in English. Okay? So there is a very, very striking change going on in science. And to give you a better view of this, why don't we take a look at a map of research collaborations over a five-year period. This was put together by a gentleman named Olivier Bouchon. It's all over the internet, but I got this from his website. He works for a company called Science in Malco, who creates images of scientific collaboration, citations, various other bibliometric manipulations that they do. But this one is particularly interesting. And what it it shows, first of all, is that the vast majority of science is still done in what we would consider to be the advanced countries, the wealthier countries, the OECD countries. And yet, in a way, the sun is setting on this era, the modern era, when scientific research was really controlled to a large degree by this handful of countries, because it's really mostly Western Europe and the US, Canada, Japan, Japan much more recently, of course. But what you can see on this map is that the level of collaboration around the world is really enormous now, bringing in large new portions of the globe. This is very, very new. And this is all taking place in English. And in fact, when I showed this in a talk I gave recently at the National Academy of Sciences, someone raised their hand and interrupted me, which was with a great comment. He said, "Isn't that a map of English competence in the scientific community around the world?" And I said, "Wow, so I'll let you say that." But it's quite possible in a way. So, interesting image. Now here's another version. This is for the UK alone, but with collaborations for another 5 year period. Outside of the EU. So here you can see a large amount of collaboration across the pond to the US, but enormous amounts in Africa, not only ex-British colonies as well, plus a fair bit in the Middle East, as well as East Asia. So this is all quite new. And Europe has a major program now to try and expand this for all countries, all that are doing major research. In the EU, which pretty much includes almost everyone now. So there's a lot going on, and science really has entered a new era. This is really in the background of what's going on. It's a very, very dynamic time. And for people who are young, as I was once, people who are young and are getting into the research world, the opportunities for you to move around the globe are far beyond what they have ever been before. But this is equally true for English-speaking scientists anywhere else. Now, good or bad? There's been a fair bit of press that it's bad, but I want to counter that to some degree, and I discuss a lot of issues regarding this in the book. So if you're not so good, I'll put it this way. You don't speak English. Generally speaking, you're in a bad position. If you want to publish in an international journal, a high-impact, well-recognized journal that can get you posts in many different places or attract company industry attention to you. So there can be bias against you also if you are, for example, working in an English-speaking country and your English is broken, not all there. So that's a certain form of prejudice that exists. Now, more serious is the marginalization of these same scientists who may publish in their own language, whether it be Spanish or Russian or Chinese or Arabic, modern Arabic. But that never sees the dark of print in terms of an international audience. Or in the case of Spanish, which is probably the largest, next largest world language, it will stay within the Latin American community unless it is somehow translated and the copyright can be released by the original publisher. But without English, you are confined to a more domestic exposure. The other thing that's not so good is that a lot of good science does not get transmitted around the globe. So it's very difficult to say, and it would be ridiculous to say this, that all the science that takes place in Brazil in Portuguese and is published in Portuguese is not what we're seeing. We know that that is not going to be true. And certainly it's not going to be true in Russian or Chinese or Spanish as well, and a number of other languages. So there's a lot that we don't see. There's a lot that is not available right now. Now, at the same time, there are good things about the local language that I think, in my opinion, outweigh the not so good. One of them is the increased collaboration, which is enormous. And I know some of you have probably experienced this. Certainly I have, working with people all over the world, Unfortunately, people I'll never meet, I'll never get to shake hands with, who I know through an email handle. But if I sat next to them in a conference, I wouldn't know who they were, even though we were best friends long distance. Still, there's interaction that way. Now, scientific meanings, the shared language is incalculable in terms of its profitability for people to interact, to come up with new ideas, share things, all of that. So this a single tongue for the system of scientific research has a great deal of potency to expose people to each other. The other thing is the mobility and the opportunities for jobs, for training also, for people in let's say East Asia, which are sending, and South Asia, sending a large number of students to the United States, to Australia, but also to Scandinavia, where English is taught and learned to a very fluent level, and Holland as well. Now, the third good aspect I have down here really should be qualified. All nations don't really have access to the same data because there are resource constraints, right? Cambodia is not going to have the same access to data that South Korea is. It just doesn't have the internet access. It doesn't even have the priorities of scientific research. 98% of the people who live in Cambodia are on subsistence agriculture. So this is a bit of an exaggeration. Nonetheless, large portions of the developing world that do see STEM as their future. It's not only in the US that science, technology, engineering, and mathematics are viewed as an economic engine for the future. This is seen this way all around the world. Putting money into that, priority into that, gives them access to a lot of the same information that we have, if they are English competent. So that's a very important thing, because if science is going to globalize further, and it will, a global language will make this much more efficient and much more certain. And when you think of it, it's a very important era for this to happen, for a lot of the world to try and move towards the millennium goals that have been set by the UN. So the ability to share and collaborate and to learn from the most advanced techniques in research and the best data is something I think that is winding up being very good for the world. And the other thing is that there's more good science through English as a global language. I think English encourages that. Doesn't necessarily make it so, but it makes it more possible than it would be in scattering of languages. Okay, so I mentioned before that English is not the first great lingua franca of science. And we have Copernicus and Al-Khwarizmi and Shen Kuo, all great scientists in their respective languages of Latin and Arabic and Chinese to tell us this. But I want to share with you certain things that we might learn from the past. This is a chronology, really, a timeline that I've been working on for a little while. And it involves a lot of information. Mostly, it had two different forms. It shows in solid color bar the period of active scientific advance in each specific language. These are a number of languages that I've chosen, particularly as having the largest degree of contribution to world science over time. And that includes the scientific revolution in Europe. For a great deal of the information came in Arabic and Chinese and Sanskrit, not just Greek, sorry to say. Came into Europe through the 12th century Renaissance, which took place through translation into Latin from Arabic, which had absorbed a great deal of Chinese and Sanskrit learning. It's a very, very, very important era in Western history. But in any case, the solid colors here indicate eras of active advance, whereas the dotted areas and the lighter colors indicate areas where periods of time when The advance was much less active, but texts were preserved, either in libraries through copying, or in China's case, through printing, because China had print very, very early. And you could draw arrows between a number of these showing the movements of knowledge and translation. But as we get to the modern era, we have a new kind of phenomenon. And that's when we don't have a single lingua franca. It's really the era of national languages, from the death of Latin, which is really, you could pinpoint the death of Latin in terms of science, probably about 1680 to 1700. Newton was one of the last people who wrote a very, very important work in Latin. And then he had to do an English version. And then it was translated into more common language by John Kyle, one of his friends. But for the most part, there were partial lingua franca, French in the 18th century, German in the late 19th, and then into the early 20th century, until World War I. There was actually an embargo against German scientists after World War I for a number of years at international conferences, and also in international publishing. A lot of German scientists were not able to publish in international journals, only in their own. But during this period, national languages really held sway. And English has come on at a very, very recent time. And it is a historic break again to a major lingua franca. So this is a very simple description of a vast amount of historic information, a fair bit of which I've been through for another book. And it was published a while ago again by Chicago. In any case, English has just begun. We are really just through the door of a new era in terms of language and science and all that that could mean. So, these are a few of the themes that I wanted to share with you today. Major lingua franca lasted a long time. This is one of the things that we would learn from history. Sometimes much longer than the empires that gave them introduction, such as the Arab Empire, the Islamic Empire that began. Now, the status of these lingua franca is such as to marginalize other languages in which science may have advanced to that point. So there are episodes of major translation, the movement of knowledge from one culture and one language into another. So Arabic is very crucial for that, and a great deal of knowledge was translated by various Arab scholars early on. Now, the other thing about that is that it obligates any scholar with any real ambition to learn that particular language. A great number of the scholars in the Arab world, the golden age of the Arab world, were not from Arabia, not at all. They were from Persia. They were from as far north as Kazakhstan, some were from Egypt, a number were from Al-Andalus, which is Spain, and still others were from westernmost India. This was a language that they had to learn, and that they chose to do so, and that often they were brought to centers of knowledge, such as Baghdad. But this was something that they felt very strongly they had to do to pursue their career, their intellectual career. So, in a way, a great lingua franca acts as a nourishing factor. It brings minds together, collects them together. They add their own ingredients, and sometimes their own cultural background. Taba ibn Kura, for example, a very, very famous astronomer in the 10th century, came from a small town in southern Anatolia, Turkey, called Haran, which was full of star worshippers. And the cults there were to memorize as many of the stars as you could. And he came from there and from that background into astronomy and astrology and achieved a very, very high position in the court of the Abbasids in Baghdad. But he brought that cultural background with him. So, in my view, a globalized science just taps into that much more experience, knowledge, cultural understanding. that the world has to offer, science as a whole. Science has a lot to offer the world, but the world and all its cultural diversity has a lot to offer science, too. Okay, so just to highlight this for you, and then move on. Now, why is he here? Because when I give this talk, or a semblance of this talk, there's always someone who stands up and says, English is, it doesn't matter. We're going to have a universal translator, you know, totally fluent in 6 million forms of communication. And so we're not going to need a lingua franca anymore. Well, to use a technical term, bullshit. No, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And why will it not happen? Well, it won't happen because people don't want to talk through a machine to someone else. If you've ever been to a scientific meeting, and many of you have, you want to interact person to person. That's really what collaboration is. The idea of a universal translator, whether it's C-3PO or Captain Kirk with his little mallet, is an attempt to take the human dimension out of language and its content and what it means. And this is an ancient dream, right? We always have something that can remove the uncertainties of human beings. But it's still a fantasy. You know, there was a guy behind the mask of C-3PO. And that's not an accident. And so here's a group, okay, a research team. Okay, a translator's not going to bring them this close together. They work together, they live and eat together, who knows what goes on behind closed doors. But you notice how closely they sit, how diverse their backgrounds must be. We don't know whether they know English, whether some speak Spanish, Chinese, Korean, an African language, Bantu perhaps. We don't know. But we do know that they're comfortable with each other. And that comes from language, so it's not going to come through a universal translator. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that English is easy to learn. Even the native speakers sometimes are challenged. Yeah, we have a problem. But here's the question. What kind of scientific English is this? And how accessible is it? We've had some discussion about this, in terms of journalists this morning. What is their job really like? When they read an article, we heard from someone who actually had a PhD and had taught. But a lot of science journalists don't. Sometimes they're just moved from the news desk to the science desk. So what are they facing in scientific English today? I'm going to give you a brief empirical look. So let's go back to 1955. This is the premier North American geologic journal, mostly an academic journal, the GSA, the Geologic Society of America. So here's the very beginning of the introduction to it. An article on fracturing by the famous geologist Ernst Kloos, who said the importance of fractures can hardly be exaggerated. Most likely, man could not live if rocks were not fractured. That's a nice rhythm to it. The loosening of rocks, formation of soil, and erosion would become next to impossible. Yes, I want you to kind of keep that in your head, that type of language, that type of speech, the type of embrasure that it has. And then we'll jump forward 30 years. It'd be nice to do this every 10 years, but there's limited time, and I know that you're in the midst of peristalsis right now, and part of my job is to try and keep you away for the next speaker. So here we go. I'm just out of grad school. Struggling to think about what to write for my thesis. But here we get a very different kind of feeling. The breakdown of rocks by freezing or frost cracking has been a subject of great interest to geomorphologists. So we're not talking about man anymore. We're talking about geomorphologists for many years. So it's pretty expansive. Frost action has been considered to be of paramount importance in the development of landscapes. Okay, so this is important stuff, right? It's broadly applicable. Okay, geomorphologists are going to be especially interested, but we can read this and gain entrance to the article. There's no bar here. There's no lock gate in front of us. This is 1985. Now, we go forward. We can't quite go couple of years in the future, but we'll stick to 2013. So I want you to read this.
Yes, one sentence.
But this is very interesting. This is the way geology is written today. Compared to the other two writings, this is an abstract. You know, maybe it's been boiled down. Right? You can see that all the colloquial, all the literary aspects have been banished. Interestingly here, this is written by a combination of people from Italy, the US, and China. Whereas the other two were written only by Americans. So we see a lot of very interesting things here, and it seems to disturb Darwin too. He's not, you know, as a great author, he's not particularly happy with this. But I can't say I blame him. So just as a quick roundup, we see that scientific discourse in English, particularly geology, has become a lot more stylized, more formal, and essentially jargon dependent. We could take blocks of text and fit them together almost in an algorithmic kind of way. And that's very interesting because if you're learning English, that's easier, right? Than being able to write like Ernst Clouse in a nice colloquial, slightly literary way, but also scientific. That's a real narrative capability to mix science and a little bit of literary content that way. But you have to know the language much better than just fitting big pieces. So that's interesting and may be helpful to people who are researchers. But in terms of the public, no, not at all. And I don't see any chance that this is going to reverse. If anything, it will go further in this direction. So that sciences will become more and more impenetrable. There will be bars across the doorway to enter any art. Most of you would not go any further than this, and boy, if you did, you know, you deserve a medal, a red badge of courage, something. But more science puts people off, including scientists from other fields, than it used to. So I would say that journalists are really faced with the task of translation. To read something like this and then to turn it into a whole new discourse that the public can understand, that is a real challenge. And I think in some ways we need to appreciate that as scientists. Plus, they have deadlines, they have editors squawking at them, they have to worry about advertisers, you know, and then all the economic data, and they have to sell the news. Journalists inhabit a very different world than we do. It's a very, very different. Can't really apply the same standards to them. Although, they still have to get things right, you know? They still have to be accurate. But they do face a whole different set of monsters and demons than we do. Now, this is a brand new phenomenon that I've detected. And I want to show it to you. This is from the Journal of African Earth Sciences. This is written, the first author is an Egyptian. So seismicity of Egypt is attributed, and we would say the seismicity, geologists would, that very deadly word, T-H-E, which is very difficult, to the relative tectonic motion between African, Arabian, and we would say the African, Arabian, and Eurasian plates again. The identification of active fault planes in these seismogenic zones is essential for the potential seismic hazard that may carry on the closed urban cities. Now, no, I don't know how to translate that. But I know what he means. Right? He means this is important information because there's seismic hazards in big cities in Egypt. But this is not normal English. Some editors would say this is wrong. Strike it out. In Science or Nature, and in a lot of big name journals, they would change it. But this is not happening everywhere anymore. Journals are beginning to accept non-standard science in English from people, all non-Anglophone people, researchers around the world. This is very new, and it's applying an interesting set of pressures in the international zone. Whether this will expand, some editors say, no, these guys will learn their English a lot better and they'll stop this. Hard to tell. So this is part of the dynamism of having a world language and having many, many, many people around the world. But this is a second, third, or even fourth language, writing. So it's a very interesting time, I would say. And English, as a scientific language, is a very interesting thing to study. Because again, we are just at the beginning of this. So, what kind of English are they writing? How good are they? These are questions that we often ask ourselves, even if silently, tacitly, when we go to a scientific meeting. What can I say? What will they say? Someone with a strong accent. So maybe the next time we go to a scientific meeting, we do encounter someone with a very strong accent, we'll listen to them a little more than we might have in the past. Okay, thank you. Questions? Yes.
I just find it really interesting that we're talking about lingua franca, and out of that, we actually need translators to understand the English that's being written about. It's kind of a weird.
No, you're right. Yeah, I would agree with that. Strange, I don't know if I would call it strange, but it's a very interesting phenomenon. The evolution of scientific discourse itself. It's a very rich subject, and there could be a lot written about it just in terms of access. But you're right. Yeah, you're right. Yes.
With machine translation, especially for the reading process, how do you think that begins to reflect back on people's motivation and people's interests and people's need, maybe for their own perception of their need to learn English, become fluent in English?
Yeah, okay, so here's one point that I'd like to, I make in the book, and that I actually stole from David Gradwell, who's a very, very well-known, well-respected, and well-deserving scholar in English. He says that English now is charged with the sense of America, and American power, and a lot of resistance to English is a resistance to that. But he says if English becomes as ordinary as algebra in training programs and scientific learning in college, it loses all that charge. It just becomes another basic skill, which is really what happened to these lingua franca in the past. Then again, it's stripped of America, because English is not American, right? English belongs to anyone who uses it. And so it's not our language anymore. We don't have control over it. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Okay, so I have a question about do you see this as a threat to English linearity? I have a lot of faculty in environmental analysis, which goes across social sciences, science, humanities. And if the writing is becoming so kind of narrow with jargon, I can see it as kind of problematic.
Yes, absolutely. So that becomes a challenge for interdisciplinaries. Especially if you're moving from the sciences into the social sciences and then the humanities. So then what you're going to be doing is a series of translations back and forth, or interpretations. So there's another challenge, another dimension of challenge. So that's how I would describe it.
Last question. I wonder, thinking particularly about that last Egyptian example, how much of this do you think is being driven also by unnecessary, but artificial constraints, like word limits, where science is really adept at dropping unnecessary and occasionally necessary words to fit within limits and determine.
It's a very good question. And though I didn't mention it, I think that a fair bit has to do with that. Right. Our articles have gotten shorter, there are page limits, and journals are trying to get, are now privately owned and for profit. So I think that economic constraints have certain amount to do with that. The editors are the gatekeepers. So, and they bear all these pressures. But even without that, even very well-funded journals follow the herd. So it's an interesting phenomenon that reaches a little bit beyond economics, but they certainly play a role.